A pair of incarnates had directed Domi to one of the shacks, where she found Kane, along with Brigid, Descartes, Keb, and two more incarnates, standing guard over a third incarnate who had been strapped to a bed. Domi recognized the Tide incarnate as the one who had been wounded in the skirmish with the black-skinned monster.
What's been going on?
Descartes shot her an angry look, but said nothing as Kane stepped forward and guided her through the door and into the next room where they could be alone.
Just after you left, we made a discovery. The guardsman who got hit is now a carrier of the same thing that the pregnant girl had.
Damn! What is it, do you know?
Not yet, but we've got theories.
Kane pushed the drapes back and looked out the window at the expanse of sand outside.
What about you and Grant?
I got hold of Smarts, but Grant had to chase Rosalia down. Haven't heard anything since, but he had Philboyd tagging her the whole way. She won't get far.
Grant had lowered himself from the tops of the outcropping and was carefully searching the naturally formed corridor that ran between the two stretches of rocks. When he had passed through here the first time, not 10 minutes earlier, the rocks had seemed to soak up the light, casting the whole route into a midnight shadow. Now, confident that Rosalia wasn't about to leap out at him, he waited with his eyes closed until he had fully adjusted. Then, Sin-Eater in hand, he checked every rocky jut and crevice. He had missed it the first time, but on his second sweep through the 18-foot-long passageway, he found what his eyes had failed to see. There was a tunnel, a burrow, like something an animal would use, rising from the ground to the height of Grant's waist. It was easy to miss. The way that the rocks cascaded within the tunnel made it appear to be almost flat, disguising the tunnel by nothing more than a trick of the shadows.
Hidden in plain sight.
He knelt, looking into the little tunnel entrance. It hardly looked wide enough to accommodate his wide shoulders, but it would be a cinch for the lithe Rosalia, with her willowy figure, to slip through it in an instant. For a moment, Grant considered calling Domi in to assist him. Then he eyed the hole again and decided he might be able to make it. It was one woman, no matter how vicious, and he was an ex-mag. She may have made a chase of it for a while, but she had just run out of track. Grant ducked, crouch-walking to the tunnel entrance before leaning warily in. Inside, he saw the tunnel slope downward at a sharp angle. Getting down that slope would be more like falling than crawling. Flipping himself around, Grant leaned on his buttocks and let his feet dangle into the hole. Then, gritting his teeth, he pushed off. More darkness for a few moments, then Grant's descent stopped. Crouching instinctively, he looked around him. He was on a rocky ledge covered in sand and copper-colored dirt within a large underground cavern. The cool air of the cavern hit him with abruptness after the blazing heat of the desert sun on his face. Grant sank to his belly and pulled himself silently to the edge of the rock plinth he had landed on. Slowly, he peered over the side of the ledge. Beneath him, he saw a string of lights, just naked bulbs, running around the cavern a few feet below his hiding place. The underground cave was roughly circular in shape, and it stretched at least 50 feet from the wall where Grant was to its far side. It was hard to judge accurately, as the string of lights had been used to illuminate the first two-thirds, but the last part had been left in darkness. Within the lit area, a number of people milled about, and many of them openly bore arms. They were a ragtag group, with no real uniformity to their clothes or weapons, but they were clearly acting together as somebody's hand-picked militia. Grant estimated perhaps 25 guards in the cavern, along with a few others who appeared unarmed and busied themselves at errands of one kind or another. Grant's gaze continued to work around the vast chamber until something significant caught his eye. Off to the far right, a bank of large, upright tubes bubbled with a blue-green liquid. Grant couldn't tell from here whether the liquid was luminous or if the tubes were illuminated, but it didn't matter. He knew what he was looking at. It was a laboratory of some sort, doubtless brewing up some new flavor of trouble. As he watched the white coats in the lab work through their experiments, two familiar figures walked into the cordoned-off area of the lab. Rosalia, her silks now wrapped tightly around her, and a man's camo jacket draped over her shoulders, and Tom Karnak, looking none the worse for wear after his ordeal in Hope, and now carrying the metallic case that contained the interphaser. Taking one of the white coats aside, Karnak rested the carrying case on a work table and cracked its seals. Grant shifted his position, wishing he could somehow get closer. An instinct, a sixth sense, suddenly nudged him, and he looked around him, certain he was being watched. There was no one there, no one to the sides or behind him. He rolled carefully away from the edge and looked down the sloped side that led down to the cavern floor. No one was there either. Warily, his senses still on high alert, Grant turned back to the scene in the cavern. If Karnak was here, then that meant that this was the storage depot, or at least one of them. And with the laboratory, Grant deduced, this had to be the place that the brigand leader had alluded to when he had bragged of his experiments with hybrid DNA. As the thought struck him, Grant felt the weight of the Sin-Eater pistol in his hand. Where a moment before it had been an irrelevance, no more noticeable than the clothes he wore, suddenly it felt like a coiled snake waiting to strike. A well-placed shot in this enclosed area, and those chemicals would go up in flames. Then it would be all over for Karnak's new baronies before they had even been born. Grant glanced up automatically and saw the boy, Ben-Gil, the guide who had taken them to Karnak's negotiating rooms back in Hope, sitting atop a higher ledge, his feet dangling casually over the side. The atmosphere in the cavern changed immediately. Suddenly the banded guards were alert, checking their weapons as they rushed across the cave toward Grant's hiding place as Ben-Gil pointed him out. Mariah Falk stared at the impressive view from the San Francisco mountain range as she followed Edwards along the thin trail leading to the summit of Humphrey's Peak. It was so strange to see how little it had changed since she was last here, more than 200 years before. Like a number of the Cerberus personnel, Falk had endured an extended period of cryogenic hibernation while the Russo-American conflict played out, and had missed the terrible years that had followed, when North America had been nothing more than the aptly named Deathlands. When Mariah had shown her findings to Lakesh earlier that day, he had immediately agreed that the triangulated epicenter of the quakes here in Arizona was worth checking, in case anything new was brought to light. Mariah formed one-third of an investigation team, along with Clem Bryant, for moral support, and Edwards, who was assigned to bodyguard duties. Together, the group had swiftly jumped to a nearby military redoubt, leaving them with a short hike to reach the mountain peak.
You seem pensive, Mariah. Something wrong?
Mariah slowly turned to look at Clem. He had been following a few paces behind her on the narrow path, showing no signs of exhaustion as he hefted a large backpack full of supplies.
I was just remembering the last time I was here. Must have been Christmas 1978, or maybe 79. I came here with a group of college friends, did some skiing at Coconino, probably hiked along this very trail.
How was it? The skiing, I mean.
Dreadful. No sense of balance, scared of going fast, convinced I was going to break both legs. I was pitiful.
From a little higher up the path, Edwards turned to look at his companions.
Hurry up!
The former mag had shaved his hair to a severe crew cut that showed off his bullet-bitten right ear, and he wore an olive-drab undershirt that clung to his rippling muscles.
You two girls, finish your slumber party and let's get moving!
Mariah turned back to the path, shaking her head and preparing herself for the last half-mile trek to the site she had identified.
I don't know what it is you two find to dawdle over out here.
Clem raised his eyebrows in amusement.
Something funny?
I detect an air of tension, Mr. Edwards.
And I wonder why that is. I'm off on a wild goose chase with a rock lover and a cook. Unfucking believable. Come on!
The three of them finally reached the epicenter of the quakes, and Edwards walked away to check their immediate surroundings. Clem watched as Edwards left the clearing, checking for traps or watching eyes.
That man certainly has a lot of anger.
Mariah was working at a sextant on a tripod, comparing its readings to the notation she had penciled onto her map.
He's got a good point, though, Clem. It could be a wild goose chase.
Oh, walking the fresh mountain air is a good use of time.
You know what I mean.
I do. But just look around you, Mariah. Feel that cool air in your throat. It's invigorating, isn't it?
We live on a mountain.
No, we live in a mountain. And most of the time, we simply work in a mountain.
You love all this, don't you?
Me? I'm a diver. Under the sea is my chosen habitat. This is about as far away from that as anyone's likely to find.
Which doesn't answer my question.
It's nice to get away from the office early once in a while.
Mariah raised a finger to get his attention, her nose buried in one of the maps she had brought with her.
We're about 400 yards from where we need to be.
Clem stepped across, reaching for the sextant.
Well, then I'll do the carrying while you lead the way.
Mariah, Clem, and Edwards pushed through the rugged terrain, with Clem wielding the long-legged sextant like a staff.
Do you realize that this was all a hot zone less than a century ago?
Well, you wouldn't think it today. It's remarkable the way nature humbles even the most forceful human attempts to destroy her.
Mariah pointed to her left.
There, do you see it?
Clem looked where she was indicating and saw a shadowy crack running across the surface of the mountain, cutting through the scrubby grass there.
That looks like our quake site, all right.
The crack ran more than a quarter of a mile and was wide enough to drive a tank through at its largest divide.
They're shearing here. The quake literally pushed half the mountain up by perhaps 5 feet.
Now, 5 feet isn't so much.
For a mountain?
Are you saying that the whole mountain has moved?
That in itself isn't so unusual.
I detect a butt in there somewhere.
Would you accept woman's intuition as a good enough reason to explore this crevice?
Edwards looked doubtful, but Clem just smiled.
I can't think of a single better reason.
Clem reached for his backpack and began unloading climbing gear. Edwards still looked uncomfortable.
I don't know, guys.
Oh, come on, Edwards. Where's your sense of adventure?
At the back end of the line, behind my sense of caution and my sense of self-preservation.
I tell you what, I'll go in first, and if you hear me screaming, you can all run away.
My orders are to keep you two safe. This isn't my idea safe.
Clem looked up at Edwards and Mariah as he tightened the climber's harness around his waist.
Well, if our parents had played it safe, we'd never have been born. Come on, let's see what's down there.
As Edward stood there, feeding the climbing line slowly through his hands while Clem disappeared from view, Mariah considered what a strange contradiction Clem Bryant was. He was urbane, never took offense, and he demonstrated a passing knowledge in many fields. And out here in the field, the men showed no fear, and was certainly not showing the behavior she expected from the bookworm and chef she knew from Cerberus. Following Domi's directions, two of Descartes' incarnate warriors shared a solar-powered chariot to pick up its missing twin. All Domi needed to do was point in its general direction. The landscape was so bleak that it would be easy to spot the discarded buggy, even from a distance, a little square blot on the sand. The incarnate driving the chariot wore a stylized cat mask over his features, while his companion was the bug-faced man who had suffered a bloody nose in Rosalia's lightning-fast attack. The bug-masked man, whose name was Amun, had volunteered for the assignment, determined to regain some honor after his disastrous earlier performance. They raced over the dunes until Farouk, in the cat mask, pulled the two-wheeled vehicle to a stop, a few feet from the unit that Smarts and Rosalia had abandoned. Farouk pointed to the discarded vehicle, and Amun stepped from the back plate. Amun looked up instinctively, the metallic blue paint on his bug mask catching the sun.
Do you hear something? Whirring, the buzzing sound?
I hear it.
Farouk pointed with his staff toward the west, and Amun peered in the same direction. Out there, close to the horizon, a cloud of billowing sand was being tossed into the air. The plume of sand caught on the breeze, dragging like a mist toward the north. As the two incarnates watched, the cloud grew larger, and suddenly they saw figures in the cloud. A dozen vehicles raced across the dunes, motorbikes and quad bikes, with a bulky sandcat bringing up the rear, their wheels churning the fine sand up in a frenzy.
They're heading this way, coming straight for us.
Friends of the man Smarts? Reinforcements come to collect their brother?
Amun was already standing on the backplate of the abandoned chariot, running through the prep sequence and firing its engine.
Back to the others! Quickly!
Clem Bryant carefully lowered himself through the crack in the mountain, swinging freely for a moment until the toes of his booted feet knocked against the rock face ahead of him. He let go of the climbing cable and stretched out one arm until he could feel the cold surface of the rock there. Gradually, swaying a little uneasily, Clem dropped into the hole.
Everything okay, Clem?
Clem looked up, discerning the ex-mag's head silhouetted against the bright sky.
It's fine so far. It's just like diving.
He lowered himself farther. Clem felt the sudden absence of the rock face against his toes, and he peered down into the darkness. Unable to make out anything in the shadowy depths below, Clem reached for the flashlight he had attached to his belt. As he shifted its beam, he did an ungainly pirouette at the end of the climbing cable. The bright xenon beam showed the rock face clearly, and he aimed it below him, past where his feet swung.
You need more rope, Clem? You're not moving.
Ready when you are.
Clem could see that the crevice opened wider. As he lowered farther, he found himself dropping into a circular area.
A room? It's an honest-to-goodness room.
Excited now, Clem lowered himself until his boots met with the rock floor.
Let down more rope, Edwards!
You found something, Clem?
I'm not sure!
Edwards dropped another 10 feet of rope, giving him plenty of slack, and Clem walked around, peering at things in the beam of the flashlight. It was a defined room, circular in construction, with benches carved from rock lining the walls. There was a pit in the center, likely used for a fire, and a low wall beside it separated the pit from what appeared to be a ventilation shaft. Clem wandered over, holding his hand by the opening to confirm that a current of air was flowing from it.
How delightful.
The circular nature of the room suggested that this was artificial, probably man-made. The floor was a flattened expanse of the rock that made up the mountain, and the ceiling formed a simple dome overhead, with struts interrupting the side benches at regular intervals, presumably to ensure that the domed roof didn't collapse on its inhabitants. A few rocks littered the floor where the crack in the mountain had opened, but it was otherwise free from debris. As Clem paced around the outside wall of the circular room, he noticed a low doorway cut into the rock. He stepped toward it and was halted by the rope attached to his waist. Clem looked longingly at the doorway for a moment, intrigued by what was on the other side. Then he glanced down at the harness that attached him to the surface.
Oh, well, in for a penny and all that.
Smiling, Clem reached for the buckles of his harness. He stepped briskly through the doorway and into the next room. Back on the surface, Edwards was on his knees, looking down the dark rent in the ground.
Clem! Clem! Do you hear me?
What's he doing down there? He's been gone too long.
I shouldn't have let him go down there. Not alone.
Edwards unclipped the catch on the paddle holster at his right hip and pulled out the Colt Government Model 45 he habitually wore there. Then he stepped over to his backpack and swiftly attached his own climbing rig.
You gonna be okay, Mariah?
Yeah, I'll be fine.
There's no one around for miles. Nearest Mattrans is downslope, the one that got us here. No one's gonna sneak up on you without you seeing him coming.
She nodded. Edwards stood at the edge of the crevice, looking down once more.
Clem! I'm coming down to join you!
Bring Mariah! She'll want to see this.
A few minutes later, Edwards and Mariah joined Clem in the second chamber. Like the first, this one was a simple circular room carved out of the solid rock of the mountain. The walls were lined with shelves, and each shelf held a tiny fetish, a little humanoid form no more than 6 inches in height. Each fetish appeared different, and the overriding feeling at looking at them was one of revulsion. Every single one was an ugly caricature of a person or animal or hybrid of both. The center of the room contained a dip, like a wide basin carved into the floor, almost 8 feet across. The basin contained a cloudy liquid to a depth of roughly ankle height.
Is this some prehistoric playroom?
Do you have any idea where these figures came from, Clem? What any of this stuff is for?
Not really. There's a drainage system running beneath the paddling pool.
He pointed at the cloudy liquid, and Mariah leaned closer, trying to see through the gunk.
What is this? Stagnant water?
Doesn't smell like it to me. It smells like the sea, don't you think?
Now that you mention it...
Clem gestured at the shelves that ran around the perimeter of the circular room.
These look like artifacts of a primitive culture. Familiar, and yet I can't place them.
Mariah looked at the little figurines for a moment, her brows furrowed in thought.
I've seen them before, back when I was here skiing. There was a museum in Phoenix. I don't recall its name. They had a display just like this, and I remember my friend Sally calling them Kachina. They were called Kachinas, Kachina dolls. The things you remember.
Kachina dolls? Huh. Well, do you recall anything else?
They had to do with the local religion, tribal stuff. I don't really remember, because I spent a lot of that holiday wondering if some guy in my group was ever going to notice me. That's what had my attention.
Edwards picked up two of the little figurines and shoved them together into one of the deep hip pockets of his combat pants.
All right, let's get out of here, people. Won't do to wake the dead.
Look at this place, Edwards. This place was carved out of the solid rock of a mountain. Just imagine how much effort it would take, how much energy and organization.
Yeah. They tell me that the ancients built pyramids that align with the stars. Ooh, impossible stone circles. Other crap I got zero interest in. I'm past being amazed that they did it with a primitive pulley system and 6,000 indentured slaves. Go tell it to someone who cares.
Edwards gestured to the first room with his thumb.
Let's get topside. Time to clear out and go home. Anything else needs to be done here? Someone can come back.
Clem took another look around the room before they left, then reached for the water bottle that he had attached to his climbing rig.
One moment.
Clem emptied the remaining water from the bottle, then knelt at the pool of liquid. He held the bottle up to the flashlight, examining the cloudy contents. The bottle was about one-third full.
There we are. A little something for the folks back home.
Yeah, well, that's great. Now let's get moving, huh? We've got a 20-minute trek back to the Mattrans, and I've worked up an appetite with all this climbing.
Clem turned to Mariah as they followed Edwards back into the main room, where the climbing ropes dangled.
Even critical scientific exploration has to stop for lunch, it seems.
An army marches on its stomach.
Grant stepped out from the recess in the rock wall. With his sin-eater in its hidden wrist holster, he held his now empty hands high above his head.
Don't shoot!
Three armed men reached his hiding place. Then another half-dozen hurried up the sand-dappled slope.
Who are you?
The lead man shoved the long barrel of a Colt Anaconda pistol toward Grant's face. Grant looked past the pistol at the man who held it. He wore a dirty red bandana across his forehead, dusty, unwashed clothes with a belt of bullets around his waist. The other men and women who had chased up here upon Ben Giel's whistled command were dressed in similarly grimy, sweat-stained clothing.
Speak!
I'm an old acquaintance of Tom Karnak's.
Grant watched the man's eyes for a telltale flinch of recognition at the name.
That name means something to you, or do I gotta point him out?
Still holding the pistol at Grant's head, the bandana-wearing man glanced across the cavern.
Tom, got someone here claims to be a friend of yours.
From the corner of his eye, Grant saw Karnak's head look up. Then the sharp-featured young man started making his way across the floor of the cavern toward the slope. The brigands who had rushed up the slope made way deferentially for Karnak and Rosalia, who strode beside him.
Why, Mr. Grant. Didn't expect to see you again. How you been? My man here treating you all right?
Grant's right hand suddenly slashed across and down, grabbing the bandana-wearing man's pistol by the barrel. Before the astonished brigand could react, Grant drove his knee into the man's solar plexus. Grant raised one corner of his mouth in a smile.
Not so bad, Tom, but a little light on the hospitality.
Grant flipped the anaconda in his hand and offered the weapon, butt first, to Karnak. Karnak smiled as he took it, his teeth gleaming from the lights beneath.
You keep that up and someone's liable to put a bullet in your head.
Well, that's a pretty big risk anyway, far as I can see.
Karnak stood there for a moment, studying the pistol in his hands as his men waited, their own guns aimed at the interloper. Then, almost casually, he raised the gun and sighted down its length, pointing it at Grant's head.
So, I can't think of any reason to let you live.
I can appreciate that. For one thing, I know where your hidden base is now. I'll be honest, if our positions were swapped, I'd sure as hell shoot you.
Well, it's nice that we could agree on something in the end. I wouldn't say it was nice knowing you, Grant, but at least it didn't last long, eh?
Standing with his hands raised again, Grant lowered them just a little, one finger extended as though to make one more point.
I don't see Senor Smarts here. He get lost?
I've got men on it. Sent them the very second Rosie here came back to the fold.
Yeah. See, I knew you were clever. I'll just bet that, given a few weeks, maybe a month or two, you'll have that interfacer up and running too.
Oh, you know how to work it, don't you?
Oh, you'll figure it out. Maybe even before my team used the reverse function to, you know, pop up here out of nowhere.
You're joking.
You'll be fine. Just switch it off until you're ready to use it. Blocks anything coming in or out. You do know how to switch it off, don't you?
Tom Karnak lowered the pistol.
You're going to show us how to use this interfacer thing, Grant, and maybe I'm going to let you live. But you try anything, anything at all. And there's 30 armed men here who'll make sure you walk on stumps for the rest of your very short life, you get me?
That's not a look that works for me.
Come on.
Karnak led the way back down the slope and into the main area of the cavern. Of course, Grant had been bluffing. There was no reverse function to the interfacer, nor was there any way to block an incoming or outgoing transit. But that nasty little possibility was just enough to give Grant necessary breathing space. A good lie was better than 100 bullets, he reminded himself, a thin smile crossing his lips and raising the edges of his gunslinger's mustache. Grant took three steps after Karnak, passing Rosalia, who stood waiting impatiently against the rock wall. She gave Grant a look of contempt through slitted eyes, and once he had passed, she grabbed his arm and, with a swift movement of her feet behind him, flipped the big man. Then she crouched over Grant, unbuckling the holster of the sin-eater he wore at his wrist.
You could have just asked.
Shut up, magistrate man.
Kane, Bridget, and Domi were preparing to leave Descartes and his incarnates at the little desert settlement when Domi suddenly turned her head.
Shh, roamers.
Kane's eyes flicked to her as the albino woman walked across to the window of the shack and stared out at the bleak terrain beyond.
Domi, what do you see?
Didn't see, heard. Engines coming. Lots of them.
Descartes looked at Kane and Bridget where they stood in the little room.
It could be my men returning.
More than that. Combustion engines. Old school tech.
Coming here? But that makes no sense. Who's out there?
Karnak's men.
Damn. We've covered a lot of territory. Entirely possible we've hit close to one of that snake's outposts.
We've got their man, Smarts. Bet you they're coming for him.
coming!
Damn! Kane ran to the doorway. This is high on the list of shit I don't need right now.
Agreed.
Outside the shack, the remaining incarnates were taking up positions around and on top of the buildings, facing out toward a cloud of dust that was kicking up on the western horizon. Bridget and Domi fanned out to take up defensive positions.
Descartes, hostiles are approaching. No demands, no warning.
How can we be sure they're hostiles?
An incarnate in a mask that resembled a stylized chimpanzee handed Kane a set of binoculars, while Descartes engaged the targeting system in his magistrate helmet. In unison, they studied the area where the dust cloud billowed.
You got him, Descartes.
Seven bikes, four quads, and what looks like a... Damn, is that a sand cat?
Two bikers off to the left, you see them?
Got him. What's that between?
Descartes then realized what the bikers were dragging. It was an incarnate, his mask lost, his powerful sun-bronzed body covered in sand and stained with blood.
Farouk.
Oh, now we worry.
Kane passed the binoculars back to the incarnate in the chimpanzee helmet.
This is an organized group, people, which means they made the decision to come here together. My partner thinks they're here for our guests, Senor Smarts, and I'm inclined to agree.
This is your mess. You brought them.
Descartes held a warning finger in the man's face.
I brought Kane's team into this operation. I'll take full responsibility when I make my report.
We'll be lucky if anyone's still alive to take responsibility or make a report.
Just then, the eagle-masked incarnate came out of one of the shacks, shoving Smarts before him. The Fey Mexican was wrapped in a cord that held his arms tight to his sides, and he seemed to be having trouble keeping his balance. His leg wound had been bandaged, but the material was darkening with blood as he took successive steps. Behind the pair, Keb came from the shack, his medical kit in hand. Kane pointed to the cloud of sand on the horizon.
Friends of yours, Smarts, I think.
You should never have tried to hold us, Senior Magistrate. You shouldn't have even stepped into our world.
I like poking my nose where it's not wanted.
Do you have any idea what we do when we find magistrates roaming outside of their safe little hills?
Run away from them in terror? And anyway, I'm not a mag. Now, I think you're going to call your friends off, don't you?
And why would I do that?
Because I'm done playing around.
Smarts' eyes widened as he looked at the weapon in the man's hand.
Kane, they're here. Looks like negotiations are open.
Look what they've done to Farouk. And where is Amun?
Kane glanced from Descartes to Smarts, looking at the little man's self-satisfied smile. In an instant, Kane's left fist shot out.
Including Grant, we're down four men, Descartes. We've got the goon squad out there and a tunneling monster at our backs. How do you want to play this?
Descartes just stood there, watching the crowd of brigands through the emotionless faceplate of his magistrate's helmet.
Descartes? Descartes!
I'm gonna bow to your greater experience on this one, Kane. You run the show and I'll back your plays.
Thanks.
Senses alert, Kane walked carefully between the two shacks before him, heading toward the gang, waiting beyond the settlement limits. Pushing his back against the side of one of the buildings, giving himself as much cover as he could, Kane raised his Sin Eater and aimed it at the centermost biker.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. You seem to have something there that's ours.
A bike rider off to the right of the group pulled down the kerchief that masked his mouth.
And you have something of ours.
Then perhaps we ought to open negotiations.
From his shadowy hiding place, Kane moved his aim across to target the speaker.
You don't take what's ours. End of negotiations.
The biker reached into the large saddlebags at the back of his motorcycle, pulling out a long-barreled shotgun in a matte black finish.
That's a hell of a shame. See, I'd have been pleased as punch to get rid of this worthless sack of shit we've been hauling around with us.
As he watched from concealment, Kane saw the biker snap open the shotgun and place two rounds in the breech.
Descartes!
What is it, Kane?
These punks want to play a little game of last man standing. You think your troops can handle that?
Behind Kane, hidden by the shacks, Descartes began giving silent instructions to his incarnates, using hand gestures to tell them to take up offensive positions.
We're ready when they are, Kane.
Kane's eyes flicked across the other members of the group of brigands, subconsciously taking in their weapons as they readied themselves to attack the little settlement. Mostly they carried revolvers and single shooters, but a woman to the left had loaded up a grenade launcher. Seeing that, Kane wondered if these people even hoped to bring back Smarts alive.
I'm obliged to ask you to reconsider this course of action. I don't want to see anyone get hurt.
Too bad!
Suddenly, the bikes of the leader and his teammates lurched forward. With the eyes of every brigand in the cavern watching him, Grant followed Tom Karnak to the little marked-off laboratory area of the underground hideout.
Nice place you got here.
Rosalia rabbit punched him in the kidneys.
Shut up and keep moving.
Rosalia quickly re-established a safe distance from Grant as Karnak gestured to the laboratory area where three white coats worked at the bubbling tubes, while a fourth examined the interphaser under an illuminated magnifying plate.
Right then, how's it work?
You expect me to give up the information just like that?
Your doing that is the only thing that'll keep you alive, friend.
Yeah, but once I tell you...
Oh, I see now. You think I'm going to get the information, then blow your brains out, is that it?
Something like that.
So, what kind of reassurance would you like that I'll let you live?
Put down your little hand cannon there and tell your associates to back off. And then we can go from there.
Karnak looked at the Colt Anaconda in his hand for a moment.
Rosie!
He then tossed it toward Rosalia's outstretched hand. The dark-haired woman took the weapon and shoved it into the waistband of her silk pantaloons at the small of her back.
Everyone else, back off and give us some space.
The other brigand stepped away, watching warily from just outside the edges of the cordoned-off laboratory. Karnak stepped forward, his face just inches from Grant's.
Anything else?
Yeah. Use mouthwash.
Grant swung his huge fist into Karnak's belly. The brigand leader doubled over and backed into a lab table. Before Rosalia could even react, Grant swung his elbow backward. Pivoting on his right foot, Grant swung out with his left. Grant gripped the work surface before him, using it as a prop to reach for Rosalia as she slumped to the ground. The fingers of his left hand probed around her waistband urgently, pulling the Colt Anaconda from where she had tucked it just moments before. The white coats who had been working in the area rushed past, terrified, determined to get out of the way. Guns were being raised all around him, Grant knew, the confusion among Karnak's foot soldiers dissipating, replaced with thoughts of retaliation.
No, nobody shoot! You'll hit the equipment!
That go for me too?
Grant crouched beneath the work table, using it for cover as he pointed the long-barreled stainless steel revolver at the nearest of the bubbling tanks.
Be careful, man! You have no idea what you're about to do!
Then enlighten me.
6 motorcycles and 4 quad bikes raced across the sandy expanse to the little desert settlement, while the driver of the Sandcat held back, waiting beyond the main area of the fray, ready to mop up the survivors. Responding to a mag's instincts, Kane squeezed the trigger of the Sin Eater. From their hiding places on the roofs of the shacks, Incarnates stood up and fired the translucent energy beams from their staffs, while Bridget, Domi, Kane, and Descartes aimed at the riders with their handguns. The biker with the grenade launcher pumped 2 grins into the air as Kane focused his Sin Eater on her bike. He then ran back between the shacks, his head low.
Everyone, get down!
He dived to the sandy ground in the main thoroughfare. The Incarnates on the left-hand building had moved quickly enough, leaping from the low roof of the shack before the grenades hit. However, only one of those on the right-hand building had moved in time.
Help!
Just 10 feet away, Domi sprang from her position on the ground like a puma after its prey, leaped toward the Incarnate as the building beneath him sagged. She shoulder-slammed into his body, knocking him from the roof.
You okay?
The Incarnate in the chimp mask nodded, his body trembling with adrenaline. While all eyes were on the main fray, Bridget had decided to take the chance to secure a decisive victory. Her arms cut the air as she ran past the other shacks and headed away from the settlement. Her eyes were on just one target, the heavy-duty Sandcat. Head down and keeping her body low, Bridget kept herself in the driver's blind spot before running the last few yards and leaping atop the little tank-like vehicle's roof. She climbed across the armored bubble that contained a pair of USMG 73 heavy machine guns, even as their operator was spinning them toward her, reacting to her surprise attack. Without turning back, Bridget tossed what appeared to be a little ball bearing behind her, straight at the armored dome, just as she jumped from the roof. A lightning-bright flash was emitted from the silver ball right into the gunner's field of vision. Bridget knew she couldn't take out the gunner from outside, but the flashbang would be enough to put him temporarily out of commission until she had gained entry. Crouching across from the driver's door, she grinned as the driver looked at her in astonishment. Silently, Bridget gave him the come-on, her index finger curling to draw him nearer. She saw the man reach for the pistol he kept on the dashboard. The Sandcat's door opened, and the man leaped from his seat, swinging his pistol up. But Bridget was faster, bringing the TP-9 in her other hand into line with the man's forehead.
Relax, I'll drive.
She leaped past the figure and climbed inside the Sandcat. Within, Bridget headed for the machine gunner's installation. Inside, it looked like the Sandcat had been rebuilt. Whole panels were missing, and there were a number of rusty welding spots across the bare metal floor, the upholstery stripped away. The gunner in the dome continued to work the controls, trying to wipe his eyes and firing blindly.
I can't see, man, I can't see! My eyes are burning! Did you get her?
She raised her TP-9 once more.
Nope!
Bridget activated her contact.
Kane, I've secured the Sandcat, but I'm going to need someone to operate the Top Gun.
A little busy, Baptiste.
Back at the desert settlement, Kane was scrambling away as a quad rider and a motorcyclist barreled toward him along the sandy thoroughfare. He managed to duck between two of the remaining shacks. He climbed the small building. The biker skidded to a halt, glancing down the tight passageway that separated the shacks, but Kane wasn't there. As the quad rider pulled his vehicle to a halt, Kane stood on the roof, aiming at his attackers with his Sin Eater.
Turkey shoot.
Nearby, Domi and Descartes were catching bikers in their crossfire, while the Incarnates aimed their weapons at the attacking riders. It was all over in a few minutes. The brigands had been ill-prepared for a trained military force led by Magistrate Mines. As they were mopping up the stragglers, Kane spotted the low-slung form of the Sandcat approaching them. Still woozy from being knocked senseless, Smart smiled when he saw the wag approaching, wondering for a moment if it might be his salvation. That was until the driver's door opened and Bridget's red mop of hair poked out.
I have a corpse in back. If there's a gentleman among you who might care to give me a hand...
Descartes and one of the Incarnates made their way over to the large, blocky vehicle while Bridget sat sideways in the driver's seat, her booted feet resting on the sand. Just then, there was a familiar vibration in Kane's skull, and he activated his contact.
Kane here, go ahead.
Kane, I think I found your bogey. Still underground, traveling west-southwest at a leisurely pace. I guess the tunneling slows it down.
Yeah, Brewster. West-southwest. How close would this be to Grant's current location?
Less than a mile. It's pretty much on a collision course. What's out there?
A hidden base, I think. Tell me when it gets to a quarter mile, or if it veers off. We're on our way. Descartes, we're moving out.
We or you?
I've got a partner to protect, and I think we have a lead on the creature. Your crew has taken a lot of hits today and shown bravery in the face of danger. I think it's time you took them back home.
Descartes looked about to object, but he stopped himself at Kane's unflinching gaze.
Thanks for coming out here, Kane. You and your people. We'll stay on here for a few hours, tend to the wounded, see how the infection plays out in the locals. I'll report in to Cerberus as soon as I can.
You're doing a good job out here, Descartes. I'm proud to have been a part of it.
Domi walked past, preceded by Smarts, her Detonics combat master pointing at his back.
Hey, good seeing you, Descartes. Move!
She shoved Smarts through one of the Sandcat's open doors.
You too.
Kane hopped into the Sandcat beside Bridget. Descartes held his fist to his chest in salute, watching the Cerberus warriors depart. With a trickle of blood running from his scalp, brigand leader Tom Karnak gazed at his adversary in astonishment as Grant sighted down the length of the Colt revolver at one of the three tall tubes of bubbling liquid.
Are you insane? You have to realize that you're outnumbered. There's no chance of you getting out of here alive if you do something stupid now.
From his position of concealment beneath the work table, Grant's dark eyes flicked to Karnak for a moment before returning to the bubbling tubes.
Let me worry about that. What's in the tubes?
Nothing important.
So if I put a hole in them, it won't matter, right?
Okay, man. Let's not do anything rash here.
What? Is it explosive?
No, just...
Just what?
Irreplaceable.
I'll go out on a limb and say these are cloning tanks, nutrient baths. You've got yourselves a portable womb here. Am I close?
This stuff is priceless, you halfwit.
This is the little project you were telling us about back in Hope. The Barren Kindergarten.
Why don't you put the gun down and we'll figure ourselves some way that we can all get out of this intact.
From the corner of his eye, Grant saw another brigand enter the open laboratory area, sneaking in with the obvious intention of flushing him out. Grant squeezed the trigger. Greenish liquid spread all over the floor. Karnak looked behind him, then back at Grant, horrified.
Gun pulled a little to the right. Now you tell your boy there to back the hell off before I shoot another hole in your precious stock.
Karnak turned toward the sneaking brigand.
Get out of here!
You said that you haven't cracked the birthing process yet. That changed since I last saw you?
No.
And how much of this genetic material do you have left to experiment with?
Once we get it right, as much as we want, we can just pluck it right out of the ugly little bastards.
What about right now?
What you see here, man, two canisters of the goo and two nutrient stacks. It was free until you went cowboy. Whitecoats already went through five of them. But this'll be enough. Just got to find the right type of expertise.
DNA experts are hard to find, especially outside of Ville walls.
Oh, tell me about it. Didn't your lady friend, that pretty redhead, say she was a gene scientist?
Why? You thinking of cutting a deal?
I think maybe we got off on the wrong foot. There's a ton of money to be made from this little enterprise if we just pool our talents. You with that lanky geneticist woman, me with the gunk she needs to work with. What say you, Grant, my boy?
A partnership?
Karnak held his open hand in Grant's direction.
Yeah, that'll work. We break this DNA sequencing code and, well, there'll be plenty of riches to go around, eh?
Grant edged warily out of his hiding place and stood before Karnak, eyeing the brigands who stood all around, just beyond the perimeter of the lab itself.
Yeah.
After they shook, still holding Karnak's hand, Grant pulled the brigand leader close, aware that this was the only shield he had out here in the open, under the scrutiny of the other bandits in the cavern. The deal would go sour, he knew. It was simply a way for Karnak to keep his little project and himself alive until he could stab Grant and his crew in the back.
We have to get up above ground so I can radio my friends.
Karnak looked at Grant for a moment, weighing his options, before he nodded and led the way up the tunnel. Racing across the desert in the Sandcat, Kane watched the horizon as Bridget spun the wheel, steering around a clump of towering cacti.
Come in, Grant. You're about to have some company of the big and mean-spirited variety.
Got me a monster coming to crash my party?
Brewster managed to tag the thing, and he tells me it's headed in your direction. ETA, 2 minutes.
That close?
We'll be there as soon as we can. We've got your coordinates, and Brewster will guide us to your exact location.
There's a hidden entrance, tiny little rabbit hole. If you're not careful, you walk straight past it.
We're in a Sandcat. How small is this rabbit hole?
Karnak, what other entrances are there to this place? Can we get a Sandcat in here?
Partnership or no, do you honestly think I'm gonna just let your friends drive in here armed to the freaking teeth and steal my gear?
Now, new agenda, and it's called survival. We have got something very big and very mean and a damn sight more alien than I want to get into right now heading this way. You and your men are in trouble like you would not believe unless you wise the hell up.
Hey!
Grant spun to train the gun on Rosalia.
He's right, Tom. I saw it.
Welcome to the party. Been awake long?
I heard what you said about that creature coming here. I hate to admit it, but you and your magistrate friends may be our only hope of surviving.
Karnak looked at her, an unspoken query in his expression, and Rosalia nodded solemnly, long lashes closing over her eyes in resignation.
It's nothing like you can imagine, Tom. A force of nature, an engine of destruction. Anger taking form and substance.
Grant, time's running out.
Time to do or die.
I'll have you shot for what you've brought here.
Yeah, but do it after I've saved your butt.
Deal.